Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. And in this last episode of the series, we have to talk about housing. Where we live is often a big part of who we are. If we're lucky, it's also our main source of wealth, quite possibly our retirement plan. But for many, many others, finding and keeping a home is what keeps them living on the edge, a constant financial burden and source of stress. And because it does play such a big role in all our lives, property has also, historically, played an outsized role in the ups and downs of the economy. In a little while, I'll be taking a quick tour of the world's property markets with Bloomberg economist Neeraj Shah, warming up for an expansive, even philosophical conversation with Bloomberg star columnist John Authors, asking why it is that real estate causes us so much trouble, and which of the following are most likely to blow up the global economy this time around? Bankrupt property developers in New York or China? But first, US economy reporter Maria Paula Mijares-Torres has this ground-level view of the increasingly cutthroat market for US rentals, where supply is tight and costs for even long-time renters are soaring.
Despite whether the rents go up or not, I can't afford anything until I get some help from the government with disability from Social Security. So the story is, yes, we have higher rents, but now the higher rents are now factoring in my ability to rent an apartment in my physical condition because the rents are higher.
Dini Keener had a plan to deal with the big increase in the monthly rent for his Las Vegas apartment this spring. He figured he would just take extra shifts at his bartending job on the Strip. Then, life intervened. A diagnosis of pancreatic cancer made it hard for him to move, let alone work, and he lost his job. Now, he's facing eviction.
I don't have enough strength. I'm physically able to walk around like a regular person. I can walk maybe a quarter mile and then I'm done, physically. So, the question is, at some point in my life, this terminal disease will kick in to where I can't do anything, like even work from a laptop.
Keener is among the 8.4 million Americans who are late on rent payments as prices continue to increase, according to data by the U.S. Census Bureau. That is 15% of all U.S. renters. As rental costs soar across the country, Americans are struggling to keep up. Single-family rents rose by a record of 14% nationally over the past year, according to CoreLogic, a real estate data firm. But the increases were even more dramatic in cities that became popular living destinations during the pandemic, including a 41% increase in Miami, a 26% rise in Orlando, and an 18% jump in Phoenix. Some tenants are seeing their monthly rent bills rise by several hundred dollars, even after years of living in the same apartment. The government blocked landlords from evicting many people during the pandemic, but those moratoriums are ending. So too are many emergency rental assistance programs. Now, there's a very real chance many Americans could be forced out of their homes.
Pretty much the perfect storm for renters right now.
That was Kate Reynolds, Principal Policy Associate at the Washington-based Urban Institute.
So emergency rental relief was authorized as a response to the pandemic, a total of $47 billion. And these were authorized back at the beginning of 2021 But what we're seeing now is that a lot of that funding has been spent down, and those renters and their landlords are, you know, don't have a place to turn if they're unable to pay the rent.
She says that for the first time since the pandemic began, an increasing number of Americans are on their own to cope with soaring housing costs. During the pandemic, a combination of national, state, and local moratoriums gave a lifeline to millions of Americans thrown out of work or forced to stay home to care for children. Starting in March 2020, the Federal CARES Act put an initial 120-day ban on evictions that covered as many as 45% of U.S. renters, according to Urban Institute estimates. That was followed up by a sweeping moratorium imposed by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which covered millions more Americans throughout parts of 2020 and 2021. However, by August of last year, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the federal moratorium and allowed evictions to resume.
So for the first time ever, in June, we saw median rent prices go above $2,000 a month. And you have inflation on essentials like gas, food, and groceries, as well as energy costs. And then on top of all of that, eviction moratoria were also extended during the pandemic, both by Congress and by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And some local places also had policies in place. All of those have expired. There's a few local exceptions. But what we did see is that during the time that those eviction moratoria were in place, that eviction filings really did stay below average levels. And so all of these things are sort of happening at the same time, which is really difficult for a lot of renter households. There is a great research study out of California that came out, you know, mid-crisis, that basically showed that a lot of renter households had what we call shadow debt. So renters were taking on debt in order to pay their rent because, you know, folks worry about, you know, an eviction filing or losing their housing. And so a lot of times we've seen that what we say sometimes is that the rent eats first. And what that means is that folks, you know, put money, their money toward rent, even if it means that they can't, you know, buy groceries.
Even when someone isn't facing eviction, a shortage of available housing and a surge of people moving to warmer climates has given landlords an advantage over their tenants. In many cases, landlords are boosting rents by hundreds of dollars, and renters have little choice but to pay for it. Last January, Carla Kelly was unable to renew the lease of the two-bedroom apartment where she has lived since 2009 in the Atlanta suburb of Duluth, Georgia.
People from the northeastern California where it's higher than here, they think Georgia's less expensive and where people can work remotely from a number of jobs now, they don't necessarily have to be where their company's headquartered. So we do have a big influx of people from the northeast and from California moving to Georgia, so there was a big shortage of apartments.
The company that owned the building decided to do renovations that could accommodate new residents who move from more expensive cities and are willing to pay more for rent. The landlord offered her a space in another of its buildings, boosting her rent by almost $600 a month.
The night I got the keys, there were cockroaches running all around the apartment. Stuff was light fixtures were rusted, light switches didn't work. The carpeting in the bedrooms was old. Faucets didn't work. I mean, there was just a whole list of stuff. The furnace filter hadn't been changed. It was horrible.
Back in Las Vegas, Kinnear's rent went from $750 to $1,000 for a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment. That might sound cheap for New Yorkers and Californians, but very expensive for people in Las Vegas. Unable to work and facing possible eviction, he's hoping to win financial assistance from a government program that helps low-income Americans with housing costs. However, his application has been tied up for months.
The money is there from the federal government and these coffers and these various agencies, but there's so many people applying for this that they've created a wait list. So I can't even apply for the money.
With the help of a lawyer, he's doing an eviction appeal to buy more time before he has nowhere else to go. As we speak, he's packing his belongings into storage to prepare to move to a homeless shelter whenever he gets evicted. For Bloomberg News, this is Maria Paula Mijares Torres.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I wanted to start with that piece because conversations about property so often revolve around what's going to happen to house prices and mortgage rates. We talk less about the consequences of those things for a renter just looking for somewhere affordable to live. But super low mortgage rates are one reason why property prices and rents have been going up and up around the world in recent years. And especially if you live in the US or the UK, you'll know that the property boom didn't let up during the pandemic. If anything, it accelerated. So now mortgage rates are finally heading up in many countries, you have to wonder which property market will pop first and what the collateral damage will be. Our UK economist, Niraj Shah, has been looking at a series of indicators for 19 property markets around the world, has some answers to that question. Niraj, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you for having me on, Stephanie.
So we should cut to the chase. Everyone wants to know whether they're sitting in a place that's about to blow up. So which countries came top in our rankings as places to watch?
So New Zealand came top, but Australia and Canada were up there as well. And all of those countries are showing now signs of cooling. The most striking thing is Toronto, where actually you've seen quite dramatic price falls. And so that's something to watch out
having for. Having had big house price rises for a long time.
Indeed, right. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But the other places is Czech Republic is well up there from the European Union, but also Portugal within the euro area. Now, both those are not actually showing signs of cooling as yet, and so but something to look out for, especially as the ECB starts raising rates from this month and possibly by 50 basis points in September.
It's interesting because a lot of the countries that we mentioned, and certainly Australia and Canada, are actually countries that kind of didn't have a housing market crash in the global financial crisis. They sort of dodged that bullet, but it also meant that prices were able to just keep going up and up and up and up, and they get even less affordable. There is a lot of focus on America, given that it was the US subprime market that played such a big role in triggering that global financial crisis in 2008. And actually, there was a fascinating statistic that the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, Ben Broadbent, calculated at the time. I remember he calculated that UK banks had lost a lot more money on US subprime assets going into that crisis than they ever did on the UK housing market. So people are looking again at the US and saying, could this now cause another global problem? Is it in a stronger position now than it was then?
Well, you're absolutely right to focus on the US. It is actually up there within what the countries to look out for. But it is actually in a much stronger position than in 2008. And I think it's not only just tighter lending standards than there were during the subprime crisis. It's also the quality of buyer. And what I mean by that, the last cycle, anyone could practically get a mortgage. This time, it's been quite difficult for those on more vulnerable incomes and so on to get a mortgage. So we're already on a stronger platform in that sense.
Sean Donnan, who's often on this programme, he had done some fascinating analysis of precisely that point on the other, from the other direction, that actually that it was many African-American households who weren't particularly poor were being shut out of the lending boom and the sort of mortgages that you've seen over the last few years in the US. I mean, more broadly, households do seem to be in stronger shape. You know, we talk about the cash that's built up in different countries, in the US and the UK, from the COVID crisis. People still have a bit of extra cash in their bank accounts. In most cases, you also have a fixed rate mortgage. So when the European Central Bank or the Bank of England raises interest rates, or the Fed, that doesn't immediately affect your the cost of your mortgage right then.
Oh, absolutely. But when you talk about fixed rates, I mean, the US has always been one of those countries where you used to have 10, even 30 years.
Yeah, well, you do. The average, the norm was to get a 30-year fixed rate, which I thought was incredible when I lived in the States.
But globally now, that has been growing. And so the UK, you have 80%, oh, actually over 80% of people on fixed rates. And significant of those are not going to be renewing them until 2 years' time down the line. So they've got that breathing space to adjust and adapt.
You point out, and in the piece that you've written, you point out that house prices are a record high globally. There's an International Monetary Fund Global House Price Index, which is higher now even than it was before the last crash. And we know in the US and in UK and Europe, it's a constant source of discussion how difficult it is for young people to get on the housing ladder, to buy houses. Yet, you know, when governments try to address this, the last thing that they would appeal to is the idea of actually a fall in house prices that would be the most direct way of making houses more affordable. And instead, they have ways to coax people into buying houses and having less and needing less and less money to buy a house. We won't go into our respective ages, but you will have, I'm sure, lots of friends who've faced this issue, even with quite well-paid jobs in the UK and in London. Is it just that the people who have all the houses and sit on now all this housing value vote a lot more regularly than the young people that are struggling to get a home?
It's quite an interesting thing, isn't it? The people who are on the housing ladder and so on are the ones who tend to vote the most. And the other sort of interesting thing on this is going back to how most, so the first time in the UK in many decades, you've got more people who own their home outright than have mortgages. The government is quite aware of all this. So it sort of gives these trinkets of little things, oh, we're doing something to get you on the ladder. But home ownership has gone significantly down for those on the lowest income groups and young age people, basically. It's halved over the last, I think, 15 years. And that's, you know, that's quite a shocking, really.
With you and your friends sort of, you know, more or less starting out in the working force or quite early in your careers, if you turn on the TV tonight and it said house prices are going to fall by 10% or 20%, and strip out the fact that you're an economist and you would worry about all the consequences, but just among your friends, do you think they would think it was good news?
I can definitely imagine for a few of my friends, they'd be absolutely celebrating. They do wish there's a housing crash. I say, oh, this is about time. And they do resent
all the enormous lengths that governments try and go to prevent one.
But again, this is the thing. Governments, if there is a housing crash, there'd be financial instability would be quite profound. You could have a far deeper recession and so on. So it would actually be worse for everyone.
I'm sure that's what you say to your friends in the pub when they say what a great thing it would be. Niraj Shah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com. Stiefel-Nicholas
Stiefel-Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm delighted now to be drawing all the strands together with one of the stars in the world of financial journalism, John Authors. For many, many years, one of the most read columnists for the Financial Times. In fact, we overlapped a little bit at the FT. And now, definitely the most read columnist on finance and markets for Bloomberg. John, thank you so much for taking time to be part of our season finale.
Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Yes. Good to be working together again.
And appropriately, given what we're going to talk about, you're talking to us from New York. Now, I wanted to focus on property in this episode, not only because the cost of housing affects all of us in one way or another, or because the ups and downs in the value of real estate has historically played such a role in amplifying the booms and busts in the broader economy. But also, it occurred to me in a slightly more philosophical way that it seemed to embody the tensions, the contradictions we're seeing playing out in this chapter of global capitalism. When you look at any given country where governments and those who've prospered in these years of rising asset prices, they're all doing all they can to prop up property markets. But then you have a big chunk of the population, including lower income households and young people, we heard some of them at the beginning of the show, who'd like nothing better than to see house prices fall and for housing finally to become more affordable. So before we get into some of the sort of market dynamics, where you stand on this particular issue very much depends on where you live or don't live, doesn't it?
Well, certainly where I live in Manhattan, the issue of affordability is about as acute as it's possible to imagine. One of the critical problems you always face with property is that even though people treat it as an investment, it's something you truly need. Shelter is a very basic human need. You could argue it's almost an urge. It goes back to John Locke and the whole idea of property rights, that you cannot really be a full-fledged citizen or a full-fledged participant in the economy without some property. So, yes, this is always more difficult for governments and more dangerous for the economy than stocks. You could let, you know, in 2000, the dot-com boom blew up and there was a mild recession thereafter. In 2007, the housing bubble blew up and all hell broke loose. And there's a reason for that. People can bear the notion of losing money on other assets. Losing money on property is a fundamentally different proposition. And that's why I would say you should always, in any kind of a financial, you know, tour of the horizon, you should always be on the lookout for whether real estate is in danger. That's what can tip a financial event into something more serious.
There's a lot of economic evidence now that when you look back and you say, well, why wasn't, you know, for example, the market crash of 1987 barely remembered now, and indeed the stock market was more or less back where it was by the end of that year. It didn't have that knock-on effect for the broader economy that you did see, for example, before the global financial crisis, when the US housing obviously triggered all these things. So it definitely does seem to make the difference between the sort of minor market correction and a broader economic recession. So I guess the big question we have to ask is, do you see that transition happening today? Do you see enough problems in the housing market that what we've seen in the financial markets in the last few months, possibly a bear market now, that's going to turn into something much worse?
I do see the real possibility of that. I wouldn't say it was yet an inevitability. If you start with the States, then yes, house prices are now, even in real terms, higher than they were at the top in 2006. And demand has been very aggressive, and there is now clear sign of a turn. You've seen new house sales falling from a high level each month for several months now. Measures of housing sentiment have got very much weaker. And that's also, you've got to throw in the very serious displacements caused by the pandemic. Lots of areas are much more appealing than they were 3 years ago, very suddenly, and others are much less appealing. It's those sudden breaks that markets can have a difficulty dealing with. Across the world, the UK has long had, I don't need to tell you this, a bad habit of, when in doubt, inflate the stock market. And that leads to always the risk of, in Britain, of that a housing market can bring the rest of the economy down. It's a very housing sensitive economy. The great imponderable is China. We know for years now that the Chinese authorities are scared of a Minsky moment or a Lehman moment. You know, Minsky, for those uninitiated, is the idea, is the economist who came up with the idea that at a certain point, confidence in debt can be lost. And that's when you have a crisis of the scale of what happened after Lehman Brothers in 2008. There is an unimaginably large amount of money that has been borrowed for real estate in China. There are many property developers in very serious trouble. And property investment is falling there, even as other fixed asset investment is improving. It's plainly very much of an Achilles heel for the Chinese property sector, for the Chinese economy. My best guess is that China is still in enough control that it can manage a very slow period of growth, possibly even a recession, without a blow up, without a major crisis. For the rest of the world, having become as dependent as we have on Chinese growth, that's still quite an alarming prospect.
I mean, there's probably a few things there that we should pick up on, but just going back to the US, I mean, and it came up earlier in the program as well that, you know, we had the economy go south during COVID in a kind of dramatic way, and then we've had the sort of interesting mixed up pattern of the recovery, a different kind of recovery than we've had before. And that has caused its own problems with supply chains and everything else that we've talked a lot about in Stephanomics. But actually, house prices had just carried on defying gravity for most of that period. Talk us through, you know, a little bit of, you know, why that happened and where you think there's most vulnerability.
With all real estate, the critical thing about real estate is that it's leveraged, which is another reason why we should really care about it from the point of view of financial crises.
So it's based on borrowed money.
Yes, exactly. If rich people use their money to bet on stocks that go up and then come down again, yeah, there are some wealth effects. But so what? If lots of people borrow money and their house price goes down and they can't afford to repay the loan, that's very serious. That's a different question altogether. You do still see prices rising very sharply in the US. That's partly because supply was actually somewhat limited during the earlier stages of COVID, and because finance became exceptionally cheap thanks to the Fed's monetary policy, which I think everybody now agrees stayed too easy for too long, with the benefit of hindsight. And that did mean that a lot of people started looking for housing. The fact that the supply was relatively limited, and that there was also the desire of some who were living in cities to find somewhere else to move, meant that you really did have a perfect positive storm from the point of view of people who wanted to sell houses. You could make the argument in terms of how dangerous that is now. Mortgage rates are, you know, have had probably the biggest upward shock they've ever had, bearing in mind how low they started. Yes, it's true. Americans tend to have long-term fixed mortgages. Many of them were hoping to use their house as an ATM, however, which isn't going to happen. for a long time at this point. And many were probably hoping to refinance lower, which isn't going to happen. So there are still very great concerns there.
And actually, we should just say, I mean, roughly how much? I mean, they're now back, 30-year rates are back to, what, around 6% or something? So the change at the start from the start of the year is pretty dramatic.
It fortunately, you know, the actual interest rate cost you need to pay now compared to taking out a mortgage 6 months ago has multiplied several times over.
So for people who are thinking about their kind of monthly costs, even though the sort of the 6% doesn't seem that much historically, it's a huge difference in your monthly payment if you were rather overextending yourself potentially.
Yes, and if a year ago you were doing the math and thought that you were going to be paying 2%, then the whole proposition, you know, is transformed, and that is a bigger shock than, you know, than was ever he suffered at any point during the 70s. That kind of speed of increase in debt costs from a low base. I mean, moving on to commercial property, I think that's where there is the really great concern, because two things. One, supply is extreme. I don't know when you were last in Manhattan, but there are now something like half a dozen buildings taller than the Empire State. There's forests of new skyscrapers going up. Very beautiful views from the higher floors of the Bloomberg building. Very hard to imagine. It struck me as optimistic even before the pandemic. At this point, you know, I go to work in the morning and I actually sit down in the subway because so many fewer people are actually going to work in an office, which is nice. But, you know, and I then move into, you know, a central business district with vastly more capacity than it had before. That is really terrifying. Putting those things together, your average real estate developer in this city, these are guys who probably don't have 30-year financing. They probably are trying to borrow over shorter terms and needing to roll over. So the one positive, the one reason we're not needn't be too concerned about it, is that a lot of the money for these guys ultimately comes from pension funds and endowments and the kind of people who can afford to wait out a storm, that they've got a long-term time horizon, but not all of it does. And, you know, we'd rather not all of us sacrifice a bit of our pension to deal with real estate. So for my money, commercial real estate is probably the single greatest cause for concern.
What I'm taking from what you're saying is that if we do see property triggering something really significant for the economy, it's going to look and feel very different from what we saw before the global financial crisis, which was very much tied up into what had happened to the lower end housing market, with the assets attached to that sort of subprime market having somehow infiltrated not just the US financial system, but the global financial system. This seems like the sort of the complete opposite, that you've got. It's the bit of real estate that probably affects people least in their day to day. That's potentially the biggest trigger point. And indeed, it could be the other side of the world's property market that this time is going to affect us. So let's just maybe come back to what you said about China. You know, famously, US subprime kind of set off this global sort of financial explosion in 2007-08. Are we about to see China's property market now do the same to the rest of the world? I mean, how serious do you see that threat?
I do see it as serious. I mean, as ever, when you're making comparisons to 2007, it's like making comparisons to Hitler when you're talking about politics. Am I predicting that it's going to be as bad as that? No, not necessarily. Is it conceptually something similar that could be very bad? Yes. You do have, which you didn't have in the States, you have had several years of, the Chinese authorities trying to, deal with the issue. The reason the big property developers got into trouble last year was because China was trying to rein them in. But yes, that has been an important engine of China's growth, and China's growth has been vital to the rest of the world. So it's a different, it's rooted in the same ultimate problem that everybody needs property, that it tends to be a leveraged investment, and that when things go wrong, it's a really serious issue. But you're right, I don't think they're going to make the same mistakes as the US did in 07-08. The US hasn't made the same mistakes as in 07-08. They have at least made new mistakes. But the fear is whether how serious the new mistake will be.
And as we heard earlier, actually, it's been the lower income people that have actually been locked out of many of the new mortgages. But that also suggests that maybe there's a bit more tolerance in the property market, the sort of residential property market, because it's not people who are living hand to mouth who are dealing with these higher rates. You and I, who have spent so long looking at the global economy and the global financial system in various ways, you look at property and it just seems, of all the assets that we have, uniquely divisive, you know, between generations, between lower and higher income, that it sets up these problems for young people not being able to afford to get in the housing ladder. It's very lumpy as an asset. It's extremely hassly to buy and sell housing, very prone to booms and busts, and it's not a productive place to invest when you think about the broader economy. Much better to have money invested in creating jobs and a going concern, a company, rather than just tied up in a lump of bricks and mortar. So why have we ended up having so much of the world's wealth tied up in such a bad place?
It's very good, very profound question. I would say partly it's because you can borrow easily to do it, and people will always if you've got a house as security for a loan, you can borrow much more easily and much more cheaply than in many other ways. So that's a big part of it. I think you're right. The sense of status that comes with it, the sense that's not necessarily economically rational, that you want to have a house, that you want to have your part on the housing ladder. That's a phrase that the British use all the time, is very central. What worries me most in terms of what you were just saying is that there is indeed a very serious generational issue to this. Younger people, like in their 20s and early 30s, in my experience, really want to own real estate because in part they can't and they feel they're missing out. And you know, they are. I've got plenty of friends in their early 30s starting families, still renting. And that feels at a psychological level, that doesn't feel comfortable. The way the housing market has developed, certainly in the two countries I know best, the UK and the US, there is really a very nasty, sharp generational divide, which intensifies the sense of inequality, the sense of injustice that we all know is poisoning, much of the developed West at present. So I suppose, coming back to your question, that's how I would answer it. It's what we can all borrow for, and it's always easier to buy something if you can borrow. But it's also that you do need it, and that it comes with this immense psychologically important sense of status, and it matters to people. That if you are renting in your 30s, you feel somewhat more of a rootless person, less of a stake somehow or other than if you've already got a house and a mortgage. Whether that's sensible, whether that's economically rational, is probably a topic that you could spend another entire podcast on, but there's no question people feel uncomfortable not having having property by a certain age, and in the current situation where they can't, that leads to very serious tensions.
And whether or not we see a big boom and bust in the property market in the next year or so, it certainly feels like something we're setting up problems for the future. John Authors, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Stephanomics. We'll be back in the autumn, though look out for bonus episodes if I meet anyone exciting on my travels. And do be sure to check out the Bloomberg News website, Bloomberg UK in Britain, for more economic news and views on the global economy. You should also follow @economics on Twitter. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen and Summer Sadi. Special thanks also to Maria Paula Mijares Torres, Jonelle Marte, Gilda De Carli, Blake Maples, John Authors, and Niraj Sharp. Mike Sasso is the executive producer of Stephanomics.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.